Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
The park being closed means we can't go fishing. That means we can't make any money, and that means the days of fishing we're losing, we don't get back. Although we have offshore fishing, which is still good, and that's all fine, but a lot of people come to specifically fish in the backcountry for its beauty, for the different species of fish.
Randy Tao is one of those in South Florida feeling the financial pinch of the federal government slowdown. He's a fishing guide in the Keys. The federal government furlough now in its 11th day. 11 days is how long the federal government workers across the country and here in South Florida have been off their jobs if they are considered non-essential. IRS workers, FAA plane inspectors, Everglades National Park rangers, all out of their jobs for the time being and seeing their paychecks pinched. Those paychecks due today. Many federal workers get paid on Fridays through September 30th for this pay period, but they've been out of work since October 1st with no agreement between Republicans in the U.S. House and President Obama on a federal government spending plan. Are you one of those furloughed federal workers? Is your significant other? Give us a call. Let us know. How about your business? Do you depend on the federal government for your paycheck and your payroll? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Have you been affected by this partial government shutdown, the so-called government slowdown? Email us at the Florida Roundup at WLRNnews.org. George Bennett from the Palm Beach Post, Sergio Bustos from the Miami Herald, and David Goodhue from The Reporter, all with us on this edition of the Florida Roundup. Welcome to you all and welcome to WLRN. Today, as we mentioned here, David, is the first day of payday for many federal government workers since the partial government slowdown. We heard from those folks that are indirectly affected, like those fishermen in the Keys. Tell us about what they staged this week to, express their displeasure with this.
There was a on-the-water protest at this place off Isla Mirada called Cowpen Cut. About 100 boats went out there full of mostly flats guides, and they're the charter boat captains that basically take people into the Florida Bay, and the Florida Bay is now off limits because of the government, because of the partial shutdown.
Why is the bay off limits because of the shutdown?
The bay is part of the Everglades National Park, and so being part of the park's closed.
And can they go elsewhere?
Yes, they can, but this cuts the flats fishermen like the bay, and their clients like, their high-paying clients like the bay because you have valued species like snook, bonefish, tarpon, redfish.
Yeah. Now, arguably, David, this is happening during kind of a relative low season with tourists. Does this cut into that business, or was business picking up?
This cuts tremendously into the business because basically flats, people who like to fish the flats, that they're not really tied to any tourist season.
Yeah.
And another reason why this affects the guide's business is because it's a windy time of year. There's plenty of places, plenty of small islands in the bay to hide out, and it's a lot more comfortable fishing experience.
Yeah, and for those high-paying customers, you certainly want to provide a comfortable fishing experience. Sergio Bustos with the Miami Herald, what other effects have we begin to see now as we're in the 11th day? We heard a lot of hyperbole, perhaps, and rhetoric leading up to the government slowdown, but here we are now. We're on the cusp of 2 weeks in.
I think what you're starting to see is the ripple effects. You mentioned the parks. That's kind of an immediate effect. But then you start to see all the government contractors that rely on government paying the bill. That's going to affect a number of installations here in Florida with all the military. But you're seeing these ripple effects where it starts now to hit the people that rely on the government to pay bills.
Yeah.
And everything from contractors to landlords of buildings to like. And it seems like everyone can handle the month of October. But come November, all bets are off, and it's going to be very difficult for a lot of people.
George Bennett with the Palm Beach Post, all bets are off really coming perhaps even at the end of next week, when some state agencies have warned that the federal funding for those agencies may begin to run a little bit dry.
Right. You know, what I've seen in Palm Beach County so far is it's been more anxiety and hypothetical and fearing the future. A couple of Congress, Lois Frankel and Ted Deutch had a news conference and to highlight some of the changes. And for example, Head Start is in danger, but the county has put up money to keep it running for a couple weeks in October, but by the end of the month, you know, that's when will have more of a real effect on people.
Yeah, we'll begin to certainly see this over the next couple of weeks, and obviously next week with the federal debt ceiling debate, which is going to rage all this weekend. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. That was George Bennett from the Palm Beach Post, Sergio Bustos from the Miami Herald, and David Goodhue from The Reporter along with us. How has the government slowdown affected your financial future? Give us a call here today at 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Tweet us at WLRN. Use the hashtag, the Florida Roundup, if you like. And you, of course, email us as well at theFloridaRoundup@WLRNnews.org. theFloridaRoundup@WLRNnews.org. Buster Castilla is along with us. He's president and CEO of Miami Federal Credit Union. And he is among those business folks that has seen this furlough impact. And as the leader of a bank, of a credit union, Buster, tell me a little bit about how your customers have been dealing with it.
Okay, well, first off, thank you for the opportunity to tell everyone out there about our program and about our credit union. Miami Federal Credit Union is one of the oldest financial institutions in South Florida. We were established 60 years ago, and we have the traditional limited charter that only permits us to offer our services to federal workers,
yep,
and military, plus their families.
So your customers are impacted directly by the federal government furlough, especially those non-essential government workers.
Exactly right. The ones that were laid off, that were considered non-essential, represented a good number of the calls we got regarding our program, which I'll tell you a little bit about. But the essential employees that are still working in the different agencies are not being paid. They're working basically...
Yeah, that's right. And that's the point we were making here. For those federal government workers, for today is payday on this Friday. They're getting paid for the work they did through September 30th, but the work, those essential workers that have continued on the job, guys, since October 1st, they still don't get paid even though they've been working. But Buster, as the leader of a bank whose customers are exclusively federal government employees, military members, tell us how this is impacting your business.
Okay, well, it's not so much impacting our business, it's how it's impacted the lives of many of our members. And let me just put this in a little more perspective, because you didn't read a lot about this. Federal workers, many of the federal workers that are members of our credit union, have not had a raise in over 3 years. They've also experienced days where during each month since April, they've been furloughed, meaning they're not getting the same paycheck that they ordinarily would get. So there's been continuing reductions in their salary and financial. They've been experiencing financial difficulty for some time.
So you've gone in and instituted this furlough relief loan program. Now, I can't imagine as a banker you're giving up loan payments altogether, perhaps just delaying them or deferring them, correct?
What we're doing is we have a skip-a-pay part of the program where we're allowing the members to defer their payments on their loans for 60 days, up to 60 days. This provides some relief since they don't have a paycheck coming in, and we know eventually this shutdown is gonna end, and at that point, they can either pay this off, the furlough loan, which I'll tell you a little bit about, or we have a repayment on the loan, which is $3,000 for up to 24 months at a very reasonable rate of interest.
And I got to just ask, what is that rate of interest here? It's because we are still in a low interest rate environment.
Well, remember, this is unsecured money. So this is not, there's no security on any of this.
That's right. There's no collateral. So what is it,
President? Hold on, let me look at
got to look at that interest rate sheet. Sure, find that out, as any good banker would do. This is Buster Castilla. He's the president and CEO of Miami Federal Credit Union, one of those business leaders that has seen his constituency certainly impacted by the federal government slowdown, offering a furlough relief loan program. Buster, did you find that interest rate?
Yes, it's as low as 12% APR. Depends on your credit score and different factors, but generally most banks on unsecured loans are charging 18 to 24%.
So. All right, Buster Castilla there, president and CEO of Miami Federal Credit Union, along with us. Sergio, it's interesting to hear these kinds of opportunities that a number of business folks have seen. They're impacted by it, their constituents impacted by it. On a national level, we've seen the car seller Hyundai offer up loan deferral programs for affected folks as well. But you're beginning to, I suppose, hear more and more now from real operators in this economy about the potential longer-term impact from this.
I think what's going to be interesting here is I don't think the American public is going to be sympathetic to the government shutdown as a whole, because most of us in the private economy have already gone through these difficult times and are still experiencing tough times with furloughs and the like. I think where it all melts together, where it's very confusing for people, is when it comes down to, okay, there's a government shutdown, may not affect me directly, but the debt, if they don't reach an agreement on the debt ceiling,
right,
that's the one that will literally affect whether it's your, you know, you're applying to get a car loan, whether you have a mortgage that's tied to the Fed rates and whatever other indicators out there. That's where everyone in the country would feel that effect. And that's the one that the Obama administration and the negotiation going to turn to avert.
And George, we've already heard from some folks that are in the housing market as it begins to continue to repair itself here in South Florida that they've had to slow down or perhaps postpone a home purchase because of this government slowdown and the impact in the federal government, because so many of those mortgages wound up getting backed up by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac.
Sure. It's really uncharted water. So, I mean, the government has never defaulted. So, I mean, it's kind of hypothetical. I assume it's not a good thing, but I don't know what to.
Yeah, let's hope for all of us it remains hypothetical come a week from today, that we're not looking at the reality of it. Give us a call of your experiences here for the government slowdown in South Florida, 800-743-WLRN. The federal government slowdown is what we're talking about here on the Florida Roundup. David joins us from Pembroke Pines. David, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
Go ahead. What do you have to say?
Well, I'm a furloughed federal employee. My wife is also a furloughed federal employee, but she's considered essential. She has to continue going to work, which is continuing to put a strain on our finances because we have to keep funding her travel to work. And I just think that I take offense to the people who try to say that federal employees, this is our time now to go through suffering, so everybody else has. I think the best benefit we've had as a federal employee is the stability, knowing that you can come to work and you will be able to not have to worry about what we're going through right now. We sacrifice a lot of things that private sector employees get, higher pay, better benefits in some situations. But the thing that we have is our stability. Now, that is being shaken. We don't know if next year this time, are we going to go through the same thing? Are we going to get furloughed again? And as one gentleman already stated earlier, we've been furloughed since April. And I don't think it's fair that we're having to be held hostage by people in Washington.
Now, David, explain that statement, furloughed since April, because the federal government slowdown, the budget year begins October 1st, 11 days ago, and with no budget agreement, no continuing resolution, in other words, the federal government saying that we will continue to pay what we paid last year, that has led to the furlough that began October 1st.
Well, that began October 1st, but since April, for instance, myself, and other people that work in the agency where I work at, we've been furloughed for 40 hours already.
Right. This is came out, and so this, we're using the word furlough, but this is related to the sequestration that went into effect and the spending cuts that went into effect because of the last time we went around this circle in Washington D.C. David joining the Florida Roundup here from Pembroke Pines, going from a two federal government paycheck family to one, at least for the time being. George Bennett from the Palm Beach Post. What about the politics, the optics of this here in Florida, as we're, about 13 months now away from a gubernatorial election? So we're already close to getting to the thick of the season.
Sure. You know, Governor Rick Scott, who's going to face a tough reelection fight next year, he has pinned the blame for this on President Obama and the Democrats, as you might expect a Republican governor to do. And he's also made it clear that he doesn't want the state to pick up any of the costs for federal programs that aren't funded. And I politically, that's, you know, keeping the blame on the federal government and as he would put it, on the Democrats.
Yeah. In fact, the chief of staff of the governor just yesterday Adam Hollingsworth drafted a letter that said, quote, "It is important that we ensure that state funds are not committed as a temporary backfill to federal programs as a matter of course," end quote. So David Goodhue from the reporter in the Keys, I suppose that means those fishermen that we heard from earlier are still going to have to keep their gear dry.
Yeah, excuse me, absolutely.
Yeah, and so how does this play out then in the Keys, which are so dependent, obviously, on tourism and some of those natural resources that are going to be off limits and still remain off limits?
Well, it's uncertainty, and that's what's really bothering the guides, and not only the guides. There's a lot of down in Key West. There's Fort Jefferson Park, for instance, and there's a boat that goes to a ferry called the Yankee Freedom.
Mm-hmm.
It seats 250 people. Usually has 100 people. It takes people back and forth to the park. That they're in limbo right now.
Yankee Freedom is tied up at the dock at this point.
Absolutely. Yeah,
not quite high and dry in the water, but certainly high and dry when it comes to the business. Arthur from Hollywood joins us here on line four on the Florida Roundup. Arthur, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you for letting me speak here. One of the ramifications, I mean, you've dealt with all the different things that have occurred as a result of the holdback of the funding. But one of the things that they're not talking about is that eventually, when everything gets settled, the government employees are going to get their money, and they're going to get their money retroactively. And they should get their money. There's no reason why they should have been out of work. But in essence, what's going to happen is they're going to get paid for work that hasn't been done. So because of what the Republicans have done, we have people that are going to get paid for for work that wasn't productive. And it really is a shame that that all happened.
Arthur joining us from Hollywood there about the retroactive pay. And we're going here, Sergio, on history. History as due course in the 1994 shutdown. Congress, once they did come to an agreement with President Clinton back then, did provide retroactive pay. We're presuming, if and when there is an agreement between the House Republicans and the Obama administration, that there will be some kind of retroactive pay here involved now, simply using history as our guide.
Yeah, it more than likely will. I think they've already voted to in fact do that, and they have been calling back people. I think some of this impact you see. I think one of the saddest kind of incidents here is the fact that the government could not pay the death benefits for fallen soldiers in Afghanistan, and what they I think the number was there was 26 soldiers killed since the shutdown began, or at least in the last month, and they haven't been able to pay the benefits. A charity actually stepped in, and everyone on Capitol Hill basically said this is a shame, an embarrassment, yet that's exactly what happened.
At one of those natural consequences of the kind of political environment that we have found ourselves in here today. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. And backstopping all this, of course, is that continued heated political debate over the Affordable Care Act. Open enrollment for the so-called Obamacare plans began, of course, on October 1st, the same day the government shutdown began. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius back in Florida this week trying to get the message out. In the state with the second highest rate of uninsured people. We're talking about Florida here. She's visited here six times since June. The visit this week comes almost 2 weeks after the troubled launch of healthcare.gov. That's the federally run state health insurance exchange website.
It's ready now. People are enrolling now. We just don't have the ease of enrollment that we hope to have within a couple of days through the website.
Now that's something for government speak. We don't have the ease of enrollment. A lot of folks are encountering a lot of trouble. And of course, the healthcare.gov was shut down last weekend for a few hours looking for maintenance, trying to fix some of the technological problems that we detailed with great depth last week on the Florida Roundup. David Goodhue from the reporter in the Keys, Monroe County was amongst those that when we saw the prices was amongst the highest in the area in Southeast Florida. Why?
Well, while the rest of the state has an average of 102 plans, the Keys have 38, and because there's only two insurance providers offering these plans. Also, there's a lot of older people down there, and also being true to its Margaritaville name, there's a high incidence of smoking, drinking, and diabetes.
Conk Republic comes to live down to its reputation.
Absolutely.
Then when it comes to health insurance prices and premiums, I suppose.
Yes, it does.
All righty, we've got the Florida Roundup here. That is David Goodhue from The Reporter, Sergio Bustos from the Miami Herald, along with us, George Bennett from the Palm Beach Post as well. We've got a lot more on the live chat at WLRN.org. Join that live chat right now, including the closing of the Everglades National Park, which of course began with the government slowdown on October 1st. Still to come here on the Florida Roundup, the state takes another swing at purging state voting rolls. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. So some will call it persistence. Others will call it persecution. The state of Florida is trying again to purge voting rolls of what it claims are illegal voters, non-citizen voters. The Florida Secretary of State toured the state this week hoping to build some support.
I communicate with lots of citizens. They communicate with me. And the first and foremost thing that they tell me is that they don't want their vote neutralized by anybody that's ineligible to vote, that may have registered to vote.
Ken Detzner, the Florida Secretary of State there. Some county officials, though, are leery of this second time around. Palm Beach County Elections Supervisor Susan Booker told the Secretary of State she was not ready to trust the new method of using a federal government database called SAVE.
Clearly, on their own webpage for the SAVE database, it says that it might not be accurate information.
George Bennett from the Palm Beach Post is still with us. Sergio Bustos from the Miami Herald. And joining us from Tallahassee is WLRN Miami Herald reporter Gina Jordan. Gina, first of all, what happened to the previous effort? Remind us about the first time around when we saw the voting purge effort.
Well, Tom, it was riddled with errors. There were a lot of people who were flagged who were eligible voters. And part of the problem is they were relying on one database. They were looking at the driver's license database, which is not up to date. It is not entirely accurate. And so a lot of supervisors noticed this was happening, and they said, we can't go forward because we are targeting people who shouldn't be targeted. So they pulled back and tried to figure out what they could do to make this better.
And that led to this week's tour of the state, George, looking for support for the second effort. And the election supervisor in Palm Beach County seemed particularly vocal in her doubts. Why?
Well, Susan Booker was in the state house for 8 years, and she had a reputation. I don't know whether this says more about her or about the rest of the legislature, but she had a reputation as the legislator that actually read the bill. So she's always been kind of a stickler for details, and so she, I think, voicing the concerns a lot of other election supervisors have around the state, you know, especially in light of last year, raised a lot of questions about this. I know that the supervisors are going to have a conference in December, and they're hopefully to get more information about this and try to smooth out some of these things.
What do we know about changes that have been made, Gina or George, this second time around, moving away from the driver's license reliability factor to this new federal database?
Okay, I'll take that one. They are going to have access to this SAVE database. And so the idea is that they're still going to use the driver's license database. And then if someone is flagged there, they will cross-check it with the SAVE database. And then it will be up to the local supervisors to go from there and to determine who will get the letters saying that people need to prove their eligibility.
I think that that last point is important. I mean, the election supervisors, with the exception of Miami-Dade, where the supervisors appointed, the rest of the state, they are elected officials, and they have a lot of autonomy. And, you know, the last time around, a lot of them refused to use that state database.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Susan Booker, I know from speaking to her, if she's not satisfied that it's accurate, she's not going to, you know, it's up to each county.
And am I mistaken, when we went through this the first time, when the process began, there were reports that several thousand people may get caught up with it. And Sergio, I think we wound up with the
less
same number you can, yes, less than the number of people you can count with one hand.
Yeah, this is the proverbial, I mean, a needle in a haystack is not even a way to describe this.
This is a needle in a hay field.
Yes, yeah. Here's what I don't understand. And if you take Governor Scott's at their word here, then, okay, you're looking for a criminal, someone who committed a crime. The crime is voting as an ineligible voter. Okay, what's the motivation of an immigrant to go to the poll and deal with that and actually vote? Unless it was a band together by some politician who brought together a huge number of immigrants to sway a primary one way or the other, I mean, that would be the crime that would really be worth chasing after. They caught one guy last year from Broward who happened to register for a gun license and ended up voting. There was one man, I think he was from Belgium, if I'm not mistaken, and even he couldn't figure out why he did it. You really are looking for a very long shot of a criminal here trying to vote illegally. It just seems to me kind of a stretch.
You're not concerned about the Belgian influence?
Exactly. Well, that Belgian bloc, yes.
Yes, be careful of that in South Florida. Sergio Bustos from the Miami Herald, George Bennett from the Palm Beach Post, and WLRN Miami Herald reporter Gina Jordan joining us from Tallahassee. We may make light of the number of folks that were ultimately kind of caught up in the first net here, but George, this essentially plays to the base of Governor Scott as we move into that gubernatorial season. We can't move away from looking at it through the political lens. So does this help him as we move toward that thick of the election cycle?
You know, I suppose to some extent. I mean, certainly a non-presidential election is, you have lower turnout, so it's more important to motivate your base. And
each of those votes, then, Sergio, counts that much more if it's from Belgium or the Netherlands, for that matter.
Right. And so, you know, I suppose to some extent, and to the extent that he's successful, he's probably figuring that most of those people are, or more of those people are going to be Democratic voters. So, you know, I suppose there's a little bit of that in it.
Gina, what's the next step here as we move forward for the second swing at voter purge?
Well, the next step is that the state will do its part. They will begin cross-checking these databases. And also, Ken Detzner is trying to get local supervisors direct access to the federal SAVE database. And that will cost a little bit of money. It won't be a ton of money, I don't think, for the supervisors. But again, if they don't have the budget for it, it will be up to them whether they pursue going directly to the SAVE database or leave that to the state.
George, this provides a convenient excuse for those county election supervisors that would not like to do it. Say, I don't have the budget for it. Don't have the money.
I could see that happening, sure.
Yeah, Tom, I was going to say that I've been a reporter in Philadelphia, and Philadelphia is like Miami, but without the palm trees and the nice weather. But the corruption is just as bad. And if you really want to go after corruption in the voting process, in the electoral process, all you have to do is look at absentee ballots. Every study, task force has always said the same thing. Absentee ballots is where the scandals are really, really brewed.
Sergio Bustos from the Miami Herald, George Bennett from the Palm Beach Post, Gina Jordan from Tallahassee joining us. This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. You join that conversation at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Send us a tweet at the call sign at WLRN. And of course, our live online discussion right now at WLRN.org, curated by producer Lane Chin and intern Rachel Morello. Join that conversation along with us. We have to talk about Stand Your Ground. Voter purge is not the only repeat issue here in the state of Florida that's coming back. Stand Your Ground continues to be focus for lawmakers. One of the law's original sponsors in 2005 is now shepherding a reform bill. Republican Senator David Simmons.
The idea of us having the right to self-defense is something that's been around since the dawn of civilization. It is something that is just universal, that if you are attacked, you have the right to defend yourself.
The Senate Judiciary Committee defended the proposal, moving it forward. Gina Jordan in Tallahassee. What do we know about this this reform bill? And is it appropriate even to call it a reform bill to reform Stand Your Ground?
Well, I don't know if it's reform so much as it is they're trying to clarify some things. So Senator Simmons worked out a deal with Senate Minority Leader Chris Smith. He's the Fort Lauderdale Democrat. This was a bipartisan effort to make some tweaks. So one of the things that this bill will do is it will set standards. It will require law enforcement to set standards for neighborhood watch teams. It will require investigators to fully examine any situation where someone is using the Stand Your Ground defense. And it also keeps someone from starting a fight and then using Stand Your Ground as a defense.
So it's a bit more clarification, Sergio, as opposed to outright reform. There doesn't seem to be much support to do away with Stand Your Ground altogether.
Yeah, the opponents of Stand Your Ground have always said, well, this law needs to go.
Right.
And
let's not change it. Let's eliminate it.
Right, eliminate. So they're really far apart. This group that took over the state capitol, the Dream Defenders, are really upset at the the tweaking, if you will, that's going on. I think they, again, the opponents want something far more dramatic.
Gina, in Tallahassee with the Senate Judiciary Committee moving this forward, does there seem to be a groundswell of support? And I have to ask, how much of this could be attributable to what we saw this summer with the George Zimmerman case?
There is no groundswell. I don't think this legislature will make any changes. This is just an effort to say, look, maybe we can clarify something. But in the House, they are going to discuss this next month, and they're going to take up a proposal to completely repeal the law. And the chairman of the committee that will run these hearings has already said, there's nothing wrong with this law. We don't need to change one comma of this law. So I don't think there will really be any groundswell. Even the NRA is sort of on the fence about this. They're not saying a whole lot about it, but they don't want the law to go away.
Well, if I could add, and I'm, you know, as a political reporter, I just kind of look at the politics of it. But I thought it was interesting in Palm Beach County a couple of weeks ago, the public defender, who's a liberal Democrat, talked to the Democratic Party and said basically, stand your ground hasn't really made a practical difference in the way self-defense cases are tried. And, you know, she said that Democrats should address other issues, you know, racial injustice and things like that. But I think whatever the reality of the way the law has been applied, there's definitely a political component. And it definitely, as I was saying, in an off-year election where it's hard to motivate your base, it clearly it motivates a segment of the Democratic base, their opposition to it. So it's significant in that respect.
Significant enough to move the needle as we move forward into the 2014 season?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say this far out, but it certainly, you know, is motivating some voters who traditionally might not vote in an off-year election. So to the extent that some of them are fired up to vote, then that would help Democrats.
And of course, we're talking about two social issues here between voter purge and stand your ground, when the governor would like to run mostly on his jobs record and economic record that he's had since taking over the state house, the governor's mansion in Tallahassee. Gina, you did mention a little bit of the next steps forward next week. What moves on beyond that as we continue on into the fall for stand your ground?
Well, I guess they'll probably continue talking about it. Just the fact that you had a bipartisan effort in the Senate to come up with some minor changes, surely they'll keep talking about it. But it largely depends on the House at this point, because it's really been made clear by the folks in the House that, at least the Republican leadership, that they don't want to make any changes. So it will be up to the senators now to convince the House that, look, this panel made a bipartisan effort. You need to get on board with this.
Gina Jordan, WLRN Miami Herald reporter in Tallahassee, joining us here on the Florida Roundup. George Bennett from the Palm Beach Post also along with us. Thank you to the two of you, Sergio Bustos from the Miami Herald here. And join that conversation, 800-743-9576. That online discussion curated right now at WLRN.org, taking a look at a number of the issues that we've spoken about today, including cases where defendants have invoked stand your ground. You can find that on the website in the live chat at WLRN.org. Still to come on this edition of the Florida Roundup, a Latin American leader has health worries and some big drama in Doral. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. We learned this week that the second largest source of real estate investors from outside the United States now come from Argentina. Tim Padgett is our America's editor here at WLRN. And Tim, this is of note, first of all, because of the source of capital fueling some of the housing rebound we've seen here in South Florida. But secondly, because of news out of Argentina this week that the president there underwent surgery for a buildup of blood near her brain, possibly caused by an earlier injury. So a lot of politics there. Meantime, a lot of flight to capital coming to South Florida.
Right. Things are not looking so good in Argentina these days, neither economically nor politically. Economically, you have very high inflation, which is driving a lot of this capital flight out. You know, you could have an inflation rate this year of close to 25%. You got a lot of government debt. You've got a government that's sort of, for the past few years, been crusading against the private sector. So as I said, all of this is causing a lot of capital flight.
And a lot of concern about the government economic statistics that are showing an improving economy are essentially being blown up.
Made
up.
Cristina Fernandez, the president of Argentina, she and her husband, who was president before her, have had a long reputation for exaggerating figures, unfortunately. But on top of all the bad economic news, now you've got political upheaval in the sense that, as you pointed out, she's having surgery now for a brain blood clot. But the politically, the significant thing about this is coming just a couple of weeks before very important midterm elections later this month, which could be very brutal for her ruling Peronist party.
October 27th, the midterm elections, right. The ruling party already was not polling that well. Now concerns about her health and a lot of questions, honestly, about the transparency of the health of her administration, perhaps the opaqueness about her health matching the opaqueness of the economic numbers.
Well, let's
now
say hypothetically, if she were to have to step down because of health, her vice president is considered one of the most unpopular politicians in the country. It could really throw things into more turmoil, both economically and politically.
He'd face some serious accusations about his
conduct. He's facing corruption, if not charges, investigations of a very serious nature, I should say.
So you've got these health concerns. You have leadership concerns in Argentina. You have the inflation concerns that you spoke about, 25% inflation. So today's dollar is worth 75 cents in a year. I mean, these are significant pressures. And South Florida perhaps could be benefiting from some of this instability, as it has in other countries.
Exactly. Brazil being another, although Brazil is not in as bad economic straits as Argentina. But this is just sort of a sad situation in the sense that, you know, we all expected so much more from Cristina Fernandez. I mean, when I first spoke with her in 2007, just before she was elected for the first time, we all expected her to be sort of an interlocutor between the United States and Latin America. We expected her to be sort of a third way politician that would find a good way to mix socialism and capitalism. Instead, she chose to take the sort of Chavez route, the populist leftist route, and it really has not worked out very well for her in the end, unfortunately.
Tim Padgett is the America's editor here at WLRN. This is the Florida Roundup. We're talking about the health concerns afflicting the Argentinian president this week and some of the economic concerns that have afflicted that South American country for several years, fueling capital into the United States. So you have met this president. I mean, what kind of personality, what was she like? What kind of leader did she strike you as when you were able to speak with her?
Well, she's very sharp, and she knew the important role that women were going to be playing in Latin American politics. I mean, she once told me in that 2000 conversation that the good thing about women taking over leadership roles in Latin America is they were good not only in the seeing the big public picture, but also the private daily concerns of people. But as I said, she chose this very leftist populist path. And what sort of shows how unfortunately it's worked out for her is that right next door in Chile, Michelle Bachelet, who chose that more moderate path when she was first president earlier on, is slated to win the Chilean presidential election again next month.
And the economies couldn't be different. We're not talking about a flat of capital out of Santiago. We're talking about a flat of capital out of Buenos Aires.
Chile has taken a much more pragmatic economic path in the past decade, and it's worked out much better for them.
WLRN America's editor, Tim Padgett, thank you so much for helping us understand the South American politics and its impact here on the culture, obviously, as well as the economics here in South Florida. Backyard politics, though, boy, lots of it in South Florida this week with the big backyard drama in Doral at City Hall. Chuck Rabin for the Miami Herald covers some of this local politics. We got to start in Doral here, Chuck, because this was a spectacle, even on par with some of those great political spectacles that we've had in the past here in South Florida. Almost a showdown at City Hall this week in Doral when the city manager, a former mayor of Miami, was expected to be ousted, but instead got a vote of confidence.
Yep.
Went from zero to hero.
It's crazy days in Doral. Joe Carollo was hired by Doral's manager. They had known each other from outside. He came in and he found some concerning issues with business deals that involved the mayor and some other guys. Stuff happened. He brought it up. The mayor didn't like, you know, that it was mentioned. The mayor decided he wanted to oust Carollo. Carollo so far has the backing of the commission.
Yeah, he went from entering a meeting in which everybody expected him to not to be able to survive as city manager, and instead got a vote of confidence by the majority of the board.
I don't know if everyone is fair. If you follow Joe's history in South Florida, It's filled with controversy, never really a hint of impropriety, and he usually comes through in clutch situations, and then it's a tiring effect, it seems like, at the end.
Give us the kind of Reader's Digest, the Cliff Notes version of that, because this is somebody who has courted controversy throughout his public career, as well as been able to remain ahead of it.
Well, he became initially the mayor of Miami after an absentee ballot ruling by court where he replaced Xavier Suarez. There were fights. It was just a matter of fighting and finding problems and removing city managers and getting rid of police chiefs and the politics of it all before Manny Diaz finally won the 01 election and things calmed down in Miami.
Things calmed down, and then fast forward 13 years and now he's city manager in Doral, surviving a no confidence vote this week.
He had pretty much been out of the political spotlight for a while. He jumped back in around 2009 when Regalado was elected in Miami. Regalado had an issue with the police chief there, who was eventually ousted, and Carollo sort of joined forces with the police chief there because Regalado was another longtime foe of Joe Carollo.
Well, let's talk about Miami City politics now, because we are on the cusp of Election Day. The mayor, Tomas Regalado, running for re-election. There are three others on the ballot, Chuck. I actually checked. The ballot is online, the proposed ballot, and you can see it. You may not recognize any of those three names because the most significant challenger dropped out, Francis Suarez. The campaign imploded earlier this fall. Why isn't this more competitive? City of 450,000, South Florida, the gateway to Latin America, as Tim Padgett will continuously remind us of, where the business leaders will remind us of.
It was supposed to be competitive until Suarez dropped out, which was late in the game. It was the day before you had to qualify. Francis Suarez, who's a Miami commissioner, is the son of Xavier Suarez.
Right.
He had a tremendous bank account. He had backing by a lot of inside influential people. He was very young. It was his first major race outside the commission, and they made some mistakes. They had some problems with absentee ballots. They had some issues with, you know, rogue people on Twitter. It seemed like they weren't ready, and he almost admitted so.
Yes, well, and he credited his departure from the race on beginning a family, essentially. But I want to get back to the competitive or the lack of competitive nature here for this chief executive leader of 450,000 municipality in South Florida, one of the leading beacons of the new economy and Latin American gateway, as I mentioned. And yes, Suarez may have dropped out of the race late in the game, but still there were 6-8 weeks to go, not enough time to raise the kind of money that is necessary to run against an incumbent.
Well, the incumbent is somebody who has never lost an election in Miami in 16 years, who raises funds fairly well, mm-hmm. wasn't up there with Francis, who had the backing of Manny Diaz and lots of other institutional people. But he's got a machine. He's got people behind him that know how to get him elected. Francis was taking him on. It was considered a good race. He dropped out the day before qualifying. That left less than 24 hours for someone else to jump into the race.
Good point. Chuck Rabin covers local politics for the Miami Herald. This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. The conversation ongoing online as well. More information there at WLRN.org. I do have to ask you, Chuck, though, essentially this is a one-horse race with the incumbent, Tomas Regalado, with the city of Miami mayor. I'm still seeing a lot of political ads being run.
He has raised about $600,000 so far, and he has said he's going to continue campaigning. I don't really expect him to spend the kind of money he would have.
Sure.
The ads you're seeing now, you've got to realize, come from the quarter that just ended at the end of September. So I would expect to see it slow down a little as we get near election time.
As we actually move toward the November election. Finally, when it comes to City of Miami politics, the District 5 seat, we have to talk about this, which has been controversial for many, many terms here, thanks to the tenure of Michelle Spence-Jones. Banned from running against, again, because of term limits. This happened several months ago. But is there a robust race to replace her?
Yeah, it's a terrific race, actually.
Yeah.
It's got four people who are qualified, four people who have realistic support. It includes a new area in the district. You know, the District 5 historically is the poorest and most inner city district in Miami. It runs through Overtown and Liberty City into Little Haiti.
Right up 95.
Now it's connected to the Upper East Side because of redistricting issues that they had over the summer. So there's a lot of new people, who are backing a fellow named Robert Malone Jr. There's Richard Dunn, who served the 21 months while Michelle was away. There's Keon Hardiman, who has a family name most of us are familiar with and who Michelle is supporting. And there's Jackie Collier, who's done work with DCF and the Children's Trust. So it's really a nice qualified field.
Odds are we're going to have a commissioner from that district without a majority.
I would expect a runoff, which is supposed to be 2 weeks, I believe, after the November 5th election.
And then the waterfront redesign in Coconut Grove, Scotty's Landing in that area, continues to be a real hot point for not only that neighborhood and not only the folks that want to use that space, but really kind of the vision of what the city of Miami wants to do with its bayfront.
It's controversial, but a lot of change. When change happens in the Grove, it's typically controversial. There are a lot of people who have been going to Scotty for decades and decades, myself included.
Yep.
Although I'm open to whatever happens, who just don't want change. There's a plan by a group called Grove Bay Investments, I believe, that would replace the Chart House and Scotty's with three restaurants, one of them outdoors like Scotty's. There'd be some rooftop seating. The historic hangar would be refurbished. One of the big issues is a parking garage that they're planning on building out near Bayshore Drive.
Yeah.
And the people are complaining about that. So that's coming to referendum. They're fighting it on both sides.
There's the specifics of the plan, but there's also the broader vision, which is debated anytime you get these kind of efforts to change something that generations have been exposed to. And the concern is the lack of access to the waterfront within the city. Miami is not alone in this. We've seen these kinds of debates happen with older northern cities that the waterfronts traditionally had been industrial and then get transferred over into public use. What's at stake, do you think, in the Grove with this redevelopment plan?
I'm not sure that... What I do know is that it's going to referendum, which is probably a lot different than other places.
Absolutely.
People get to decide in Miami, thanks to Joe Carroyle and some bill he passed years ago, that on waterfront properties, they get to vote. What they're doing is, there's an argument over the footprint and if actually more property is going to be covered by retail.
Right.
The developers say it's not much of a difference, and if you look at it, it's not. The opposition is arguing that the retail that's going to be built into the hangar, into the garage, which, though there's more square footage, it's not actually hurting the footprint or making more property on the footprint. They're also including rooftop dining as square footage. Mm-hmm. So that's where the argument lies.
Chuck, do you have a favorite stool at Scotty's?
I use a lot of them. I've got one near a bar, though, that I've used more often than
it
most.
Will be reserved. Chuck Raven with the Miami Herald covering local politics here on the Florida Roundup. Always great to catch up with you, Chuck. Thanks so much.
Thank you,
Tom. Speaking of local politics, if I were mayor, WLRN wants to know what you would do if you were mayor and why as part of our If I Were Mayor project. Now, here's how it works. You can tell us your idea by going to WLRN.org. You can go to Twitter and tweet us at WLRN. Use the hashtag If I Were Mayor. And then here's what we're going to do. We're going to be broadcasting some of these on air and sharing them over the next several weeks on the website. This project here, If I Were Mayor, is supported by the Miami Foundation. If I Were Mayor, tweet us, If I Were Mayor, at WLRN.org. Use that hashtag, If I Were Mayor. Some SoCal music here as we go out on the Florida Roundup, the culmination this weekend of the Miami Broward Carnival, a celebration of Caribbean culture, concluding with the parade this weekend at Sun Life Stadium. That's the way to get the weekend started here on the Florida Roundup for this October Friday in 2013. Program will be back on the air tomorrow morning, Saturday, 6 a.m., and on the website at WLRN.org. Program is produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Our executive producer at the station is Peter J. Mertz. Our technical supervisor today, Paul Leary. Thank you, Mr. Leary. Stay tuned. South Florida Arts Beat is next with choral group Seraphic Fire and a preview of the Fort Lauderdale International Film Festival. Ed Bell will be right along. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. It's Carnival Weekend.